Stop! Wait! You've tuned into the Doctor Who's Review podcast. We will be discussing Doctor Who at great length, most primarily the episode in the title of, well, this episode. So there will be spoilers ahead. If you don't care, great. If you do, you might want to watch the episode in question before listening to this podcast. Also, quick disclaimer, we have our own opinions and you have your own. If we don't agree with your opinion, that's fine. Please don't yell at us for it. If you want to yell about your own Doctor Who opinion, you can get your own damn podcast. I didn't mean for that to be so passive-aggressive. No, but just remember that we are discussing our own opinions, and it's okay if you disagree with us. With that, enjoy the show. Welcome back to Two Who's Review. I'm Alex.
I'm Fitz.
And we are once again joined by Hadley.
Welcome back.
Hello. Sorry, I'm pushed to talk tonight. I forgot to push to
talk. Oh, you're pushed to talk?
I'm having to record in my living room because this guy's using my spare room, but he's moving out in a couple of weeks.
Right, okay. A little bit behind the curtain, if anything goes wrong, you'll be aware. Today we are here to discuss the first two-part story of Series 3. It is Daleks in Manhattan and Evolution of the Daleks. It's the first two-part Dalek story that isn't a finale. It is also, it's got a few different milestones. It is the first, so it was written by Helen Rayner, who was the first woman to write a televised Dalek story, and also the first woman to write a story for the Revived series in general. So good for her. It was originally going to be written by Stephen Moffat, but he pulled out, and then in order to make it up to the production team, he decided to write Blink instead.
Right.
What a downgrade.
I know, right? God. I'll ask Hadley because you put your name down to discuss this episode. What was the reason for that initially?
I remember it being fucking weird, and that has not changed.
You mean you're right? You're right in the sense that it is weird. I do think that this story is a bit underrated. I really, really enjoy this story and a lot of the discussions that it has. It's a really interesting character study for the Daleks. And at the very least, it's a better Cult of Skaro story than Journey's End, which barely focuses on the interesting things about those particular Dalek characters.
Yeah, I'd agree. I quite enjoyed this story. Enjoyed it more, actually, than I remember enjoying it when I watched it, you know, years ago. I don't think it's perfect. There are maybe a couple of flaws, and we'll obviously get into it. Even thematically, it's not quite marrying everything up, you know, marrying everything that it's trying to say up as well as I want it to. But I really, like, when it's good, it is very good. I admire how ambitious it is, and even if the second episode is a bit stronger than the first, I'm glad the whole package exists just, you know, to set everything up. I think thematically, I think, is where it gets the most interesting. And how those themes are weaved into the story. So yeah, I enjoyed it quite a lot.
I liked the Dalek banter, and I think the Doctor had just a couple of moments, so I was like, I don't know if he'd do this. This is a bit strange.
I'll be interested to see what those are.
Sure. So... this is also the first time in the Revival series that we go to New York, which will obviously become a bigger fixture in the Moffat era. it'll become the departure site of two beloved companions. But for now, it's just like a little stepping stone on Martha's journey throughout the series. And if you've been following along with us and watching the episodes as we go, you might remember that initially the Doctor says to Martha at the start of this series, you're only getting one trip, and that's it, just as a thank you. And that trip was meant to be to Shakespearean England, and then in Gridlock he says, okay, well, we can stretch the definition a bit, one trip into the past and then one trip into the future. There was actually a deleted scene from the start of this episode that shows the Doctor kind of stretching the definition of a trip a bit more in order to make this episode make sense as to why he's bringing her here.
Mm.
It was cut out of the final broadcast because I think it was running long and it was like the scene that could get cut the most out of anything else.
Yeah, it doesn't feel hugely necessary at this point.
No.
Especially with the events of the previous episode.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's also another, like, small element of world-weaving throughout this series as well, because in at the end of the last episode, the Doctor tells Martha about the Time War and mentions the Daleks specifically, which is why Martha doesn't need to be explained to her. She hears the word Dalek and then instantly pieces it together. Like, we still have the Doctor explaining the Daleks to Tallulah, but it's nice that Martha remembered the story. And it's like little moments like that that make this season deceptively strong in terms of cohesion in between episodes.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
I feel pretty bad for Martha through this episode, just because, like, man, the Doctor's so mean.
This isn't even the worst of it that we've seen.
Yeah, he's been worse in the previous episodes. He's kind of soft on her in this one comparatively.
Which is, that fucking sucks.
It does.
Oh, man.
But let's jump over to the timescale. So this is obviously a two-part story, which means that both episodes are reviewed separately. Daleks in Manhattan has an average rating of 6. And Evolution of the Daleks has an average rating of 5.6. To me, this is way too low.
Yeah, that's definitely too low in my view.
Yeah. Around there, I don't know. I mean, like, I think Doctor Who fans probably have, like, I'm not going to say lower standards, but, like, they're not, you know, a 10 is like, this was a pretty damn good episode. It's not like, this is the greatest thing to grace television.
I mean, you say that. I have yet to give out a 10 for this podcast. And in general, I've found that, like the more hardcore into the fan base you are, the more critical you are about faults. Like, it's sort of like, I don't know, it's the kind of thing where, like, casual fans who are like, yeah, I like this show, fine, will tend to just sort of breeze through an episode and go, this was fun. Whereas, like, the people who are more, like, into the show will tend to dissect its faults and its strengths and its weaknesses and what's wrong about it and what's good about it to, like, a minute detail. Kind of like what me and Fitz have been doing for the last 2 and a bit years.
But you also have to factor in nostalgia for, like, earlier episodes.
I mean, that is also true.
I mean, yeah, but even, like, in my experience, and I've, you know, been watching Doctor Who back when the classic series was being rerun on TV. And I actually find that throughout the whole show, a lot of these stories are better now than they were when I was a kid. Now, granted, there are also a lot of stories that are much, much worse than I remember them being. But I don't know, maybe that's just kind of the nature of being a Doctor Who fan. Like, I don't know, like,
it might be, like, desensitized to just how weird what you're watching is. I think that might be a big part of it.
I mean, yeah, I mean, we've discussed this on the show before. It's like, the fact that we call the plot of Gridlock or something, like, an average episode is quite bizarre when you think about it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, maybe that's it, or maybe it's just, because a lot of Doctor Who fans, and I've said this before, I think if they're honest, they'll say, yeah, there are some really, if not outright bad, then very strange stories which have really, really weird narrative twists, some of which don't make 100% sense. Maybe that makes us appreciate the really good episodes more. I'm not quite sure what the psychology behind all of that would be, but I think I understand what you mean, Hadley, but I do think even more objectively, this story and the show in general, you can give it a bit more credit than that, I think.
Also, like, let's not mince words here, Hadley. You gave the two doctors a 6. So...
yeah, I mean, I'm probably going to give this a good review as well. Like, I think...
sure.
I don't think Evolution of the Daleks is a 5.6, but I don't think that's way lower than what it should be.
I mean, that's fair enough. I mean, and I'm sure there are some things that either myself and Fitz are kind of overlooking or devaluing in preference to like the really, really good stuff. Because I do think that a lot of what is good about this story is kind of unique to this story. Like, I don't see a lot of Dalek stories like this. And that's not just because there's a guy walking around with a massive brain, like, poking out the top of his scalp and a massive eye. No. Like, a lot of the... like, we've seen Dalek infighting before, but we haven't seen it like this.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the only... well, there is one example I can think of in the unfortunately now lost story, Evil of the Daleks, but I've, you know, listened to the audio of it a lot of times. There's something similar that happens there where they even say they capture these humans to try and find what they call the human factor. And then there's these three Daleks that get, like, injected, I guess, with purely human factor. So they start out, like, children playing games, but then they grow up really quickly, and there's similar themes there.
It's like Poor Things.
Sorry?
It's like Poor Things.
Yeah, a little bit. in a way.
I guess.
But, yeah, similar themes. But I think this story... I mean, I really like Evil of the Daleks. I think it's a great story, and I've heard that it's got a pretty good reputation. But in terms of those specific themes about, you know, Daleks changing, or not changing for that matter, and the infighting that ensues, I think they take that a bit further here than they did in Evil of the Daleks. But that's probably because Evil of the Daleks is a 7-part story with a bigger, more epic, sprawling narrative that has other things it needs to focus on. So there you are.
Yeah.
I think my number score too seriously. Like, I watched Madam Web last weekend. I'd probably give that a 7.
Christ, really?
It was funny as hell.
I was gonna say this has to be like a so bad it's good thing, right? Because I've been reading some things about that movie, and they're not great.
Paramedics that save the day steals an ambulance in the middle of a distance. Whoever they were going to save, she's dead.
Yeah. I heard something about Pepsi saving the day. I don't think I even...
oh, yeah, they have, like, a big fight on top of a building, and, like, all these fireworks are going off, and then it hits a Pepsi sign, and, like, the pee falls off and crushes the bad dude.
Remember when Inspector Gadget was killed by a falling Yahoo billboard? Just me?
No, I don't. Be
great. Yeah. This was in the Matthew Broderick Inspector Gadget movie.
Oh, not the Fred Stewart sequel?
No, not the sequel. But yeah, he's literally, like, the Yahoo billboard falls on him, and as it does, it literally makes the Yahoo sound. Just imagine being a corporate sponsor giving money to this film. It's like, we'll fund this movie as long as our product gets to kill Matthew Broderick.
Anyway.
Yeah, moving on. so the first episode has a 6 for plot, and the second episode has a 5.5.
Again, I mean, no, I think they're a bit higher than that.
Sure, I think, like, there are, like, bits, like, as individual episodes, I think part one is slow, but again, it kind of can afford to be, because it is setting up quite a few different things.
Yeah.
Part two has a few moments where you're like, I don't know if that, like, fully comes together. But even so, I don't really think that it should be as low as it is. See, my thoughts have always been about this story, and this might be false, but, like, my interpretation of the general fan base reaction surrounding the story is sort of like the company it keeps, right? Like, look at the Dalek stories, the other ones in the Russell T. Davies era. You got Dalek. It's a masterpiece. No one's disputing that. Parting of the Ways, it's an excellent finale. Journey's End, it's kind of not great, but at least compared to the others, but it's there's a lot of spectacle there. It's Daleks and Cybermen, and it's Rose departing. And then besides this one, you've got Stolen Earth and Journey's End. Huge episode. Two parts. Pulls in all the different plot threads and characters from the RTD era. It's massive, it's big, it's amazing. This one has always sort of felt like the odd one out, where it's like, it's not a finale, it doesn't feel that important. So, like,
it's
not...
It's a fairly... I don't know if it's quite mid-season, but it's approaching that, so...
It feels like mid-season, yeah. It's like, it's sort of like, it's fooling around that, you know, Aliens of London, or, I don't know, like a Idiot's Lantern kind of vibe, where it's like, it's the middle of the season, this is going to be like the filler, even though it's not, story to get us to the point. And there's no Mr. Saxon or Harold Saxon in anything like this, there's no Torchwood stuff, so it feels really disconnected from other big stories. But this is the Cult of Skaro, and this is a massive step towards Journey's End, like it's getting us to that point.
Yeah. For sure.
So there's a lot of stuff happening here, which shouldn't be a factor for or against, but I've always sort of felt like at least some fans have sort of undervalued this story because the other Dalek stories are so great.
Yeah.
And again, I might be totally off base about that.
I mean, I think the plot for this story, it does work pretty well. I honestly feel like the second part has a bit of a stronger plot than the first, but that might just be because all of the really kind of big dramatic and weighty themes are kind of, you know, they're all paying off in that second story. Whether they do so entirely cohesively, I'm not 100% sure, but the fact that they're able to not just include these themes, but to have them work as well as they do in the narrative, to have all those great little dramatic beats hit pretty intensely. I think that certainly elevates the story in general for me.
Part one also retreads a lot of the same ground. Like, we've seen the Doctor investigate this, like, disappearances before. And also, like, that theme of, like, these are poor people. No one cares about them. No one's going to notice they're missing. Definitely doesn't feel that fresh either.
That's true.
Yeah.
It is, though, like we've seen a few historical stories now in the past of the show that have sort of like breezed past the actual historical context of like the downtrodden, like more specifically, like just two episodes ago, we watched The Shakespeare Code, in which Martha says to the Doctor, hang on a minute, it's 1599 and I am a black woman. Am I going to be carted off as a slave? And the Doctor goes, just walk around like you own the place. It's fine. You'll manage. And that's ick. So to actually see a New York story like this actually, like, properly addressing Hooverville and the Depression in a way that feels real and respectful is honestly massive compared to what we've gotten previously.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. That's certainly an element in the story that I really appreciated. One of my issues is that the whole sort of evils of capitalism thing, I don't know if it ties in with the other themes as strongly as it could, but that's a bit of a separate topic, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it really doesn't, and it's only really an issue until Mr. Diagoras is carted away to become Dalek Sek. But, like, again, like, it's there, and I appreciate it. You know,
like, another thing is, like, the Daleks, like, let's not kid around, they're meant to be Nazis.
Yes.
I think there's a much more fitting setting during the Great Depression for the Daleks to fit in that would also carry into themes of the setting.
Oh, yeah,
you're not wrong about that.
Yeah. I mean, No, that would make sense.
Yeah, and honestly, I can't really think of any, like, plot-specific reason why this has to be in New York, other than Daleks in Manhattan is a fun title.
And just the basic concept.
The Empire State Building and, like...
Yeah, but you can create a different vessel for, like, the gene sequencing to take effect that doesn't require a lightning strike on a monument. And that's really the only thing that changes.
Like, the Doctor mentions the Statue of Liberty as, like, you know, the doorway to the new world, and it's like, surely that would be important if you're going to mention it.
Sure, I mean, I guess that is another part of the spectacle of the whole thing, where it's like, you're gonna go to New York City and not have the Doctor park the TARDIS right under the Statue of Liberty.
But, folks, what if that was setting up the Angels in Manhattan? Did you ever think about that?
He should have parked between the two trade centers, and he should have bought some crab juice.
Had the World Trade Center been built in 1930?
No. I don't think it was until last very long, did it?
1973 is when it was erected.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's a disaster of a fan made script waiting to happen.
No bathroom, only Dalekanium.
The first part has a 6.5 for acting, and the second part has a 6.3. I feel like a huge part of why they have that ranking is because a few characters are noticeably British, putting on American accents.
Look, they could be worse.
Andrew Garfield is British, and I'm begging you. It's a British show. Let Andrew Garfield have his British accent. Mm-hmm.
He's fine. Like, his accent is, like, one of the better ones for the Americans.
Yeah, he's so fantastic at, like, putting on American accents. That's why I got Spider-Man. But I'm just like, it's a British show. Can I just watch Andrew Garfield perform in his natural accent?
I mean, yeah. I don't know. But apart from, like, one or two accents, the acting's fine. It's good, even. Like, I think that when human Dalek Sek emerges, he's got a really tough job because, like, you cannot do any expressing with that mask over your face. So, like, a huge part of it is the voice. And I think of that let me just double check the actor, because if he is, like, Eric Lauren, who is... He's American but based in London, so I assume that's his regular speaking voice. Unless he was just, like, born in America and moved to London.
That would make sense. He kind of does sound like an American who's sort of lost some of the Americanness.
Yeah, I suppose. But, like, I think he does a decent job expressing as Daleks. Like, a lot of it does kind of feel very, like, this is my acting voice. Like, there is a bit of that. But I think when he really needs to, like, hammer home the philosophy surrounding the change in his character, he does it fine.
Well, I think, there is definitely a character arc for him, and I think that is reflected in his voice a bit. I think there are moments where you can kind of tell, you know, that he's gaining sort of a sense of humanity and more of an understanding of his emotions. And so when he's killed, for example... more so, I think, than actually other Dalek deaths that we've seen, particularly from the classic series, which are very over-the-top and ridiculous, there's a real pathos there, which I think is quite impressive.
Yeah, I'm always a little bit affected when he does die. It sort of does feel like that kind of, like, once and for all, the Daleks are rejecting this path kind of thing. Like, all hope for a change is now dying with Dalek Sek.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that given how, let's be honest, how ludicrous that makeup design is, which, look, that fits in line with, Doctor Who historically. Certainly, good lord, in the classic series, there are way more ridiculous designs, in terms of creature design. But given the way it looks and how silly it could have been, the performance really, I think, kind of helps to anchor it, while also in combination with the makeup itself, it still fits within the quite stylized, almost sort of comic book feeling that Doctor Who tends to have. Point is,
I really like how Dalek Sek proves the second Doctor wrong, in fact, you can change the chart.
True, yeah. We're going back to the two Doctors.
Oh, yeah.
That's absolutely correct. Yeah, you've yeah. Well remembered.
Yeah, fair, very fair point.
Well, just getting back to the practical effect on the makeup of like the mask of Dalek Sek. Part one has a 6.3 for effects, and part two has a 6.2. I mean,
I don't have an issue with the effects. I think, like obviously the mask of the Dalek Sek doesn't really move that much, but it doesn't look crap, which I guess is fine.
Yeah, like I think the main problem I have with Dalek Sek's face is like, and it's a problem because like I think the eye isn't quite as expressive as I want it to be. It is very clearly like a glass eye. The eyelids do a lot of heavy lifting, but like there's not a lot of passion behind the eye, and it's really noticeable. But like, I'm just impressed that they did it practically at all, because if this was made today, a lot of people would have just gone, let's put little dots around your face and let's like CG a face on, we'll do motion capture or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, we overlook it just like obviously the Dalek human hybrid loomed quite over like a very huge shadow, but like the pig people also look pretty good.
Yeah, they look great.
Yeah.
I think Laszlo especially is like, I think Laszlo's face is really great because it's like, it really is like that perfect middle ground between the full pig makeup, but it's giving him enough expression and like humanity to still be able to express everything he needs to.
Yeah, I'd agree. Yeah, I think a lot of the special effects, they're pretty practical. It's funny, but you know, you think like New York, it's this big sprawling city. It's a surprisingly condensed story. It only really takes place in a couple of different locations. It's Hooverville, the sewers, the theater, and then the Dalek underground base. Maybe, I mean, if you could argue that the top of the Empire State Building is another, but it's surprisingly condensed, but it still works. I think it's just one of those examples of the BBC sort of maybe leaning into the limited budget, but still making it work. We saw this with the Carnival of Monsters as well. But the result of this, I think, is that a lot of the effects, whether it be, you know, with set design or the makeup, it's practical, and I do think the story is better for it, because certainly, like that bit where Diagoras gets absorbed, you can very clearly tell that that bit is, you know, just some late 2000s.
Yeah,
like a bad CG. So they were smart enough not to, you know, mess around with that too much. I think you're right, Cuff, in saying that nowadays they probably would have done a bit of mocap for it, but back then I think they really needed to, you know, think a bit more carefully with it. And it works well enough. Go ahead.
Well, it's a bit of an slightly like left of field example, but the episode Cold War, how like for the majority of the episode, Skaldak the Ice Warrior is like in his full armor, or at least when he is, you can see like the actor inside and they've got the mouth moving through. But when he takes the helmet off at the end, the full Ice Warrior head is completely CGI, and like, I just wish they had done this kind of approach, because it's very noticeable in that one.
Yeah.
It's funny, when they like showed Thanos for the first time, like I was like, why do you need a CGI him? Can't you just put some makeup on him? And it was just such an innocent thought back then. And like that was what they did in the post credit scene for Avengers.
Yes.
It was practical. And it looked fine.
Yeah, I guess. Um, 5.7 and 5.4 for replay value, respectively. No.
Yeah, that was definitely higher for me. It's sort of similar with Genesis of the Daleks, but purely because of the thematic ambitions of this story, I appreciated those much more now than I did when I watched it when I was younger. So, I mean,
I think you're right that it's really a lot of people just treating it as filler.
Yeah, I mean, potentially. I mean, I'm not willing to, like, completely discredit that there are legitimate things that none of us are seeing that are, like, very wrong with it. But in general, skimming through the timescales, what the main thing that people can't really look past are the accents and, like, the... Hang on a second. apparently some people just really can't stand Tallulah, which I don't understand. I think she's...
Yeah, I don't understand that either.
I think Harley Quinn's just ruined that voice for me, personally.
I mean, that's also very possible. I hadn't put that together, actually. That's a really good point.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I don't know, maybe... maybe she's sort of... Maybe with the performance, but also in the writing, is meant to mimic some of the, I guess, strong sort of female characters in, you know, 1930s comedies and dramas. But, like, given that and given what a, you know, a cliche that could have been, I think she's actually a pretty compelling character, and she's able to... I'm not sure, what's the actress's name? It's
Miranda Raison.
Well, she does a good job, I think. There's a lot of, particularly in episode two, there's quite a potency there. So I think I understand what you mean with the accent sort of, you know, ruining it a little bit, but I think it works. Helps with the setting. So, yeah. I think that's a bit of a nitpick. Like, that's not really something that's focusing on the story at hand.
True, but like 80% of the episode are the American accents, and if that's a thing that's like a sticking point for you, then it means that quite a lot of the episode is distracting.
I guess so. I mean, well, and here's the way I see it, right? I think Nicola Bryant's accent as Perry is less convincing than...
I mean, that's also true. Yeah.
Maybe not everyone in this story, but a lot of people. So maybe that's just a point of comparison.
Almighty have fallen that we compare episodes to the Colin Baker era.
Part 1, 23 out of 92 say this requires a previous story. With part 2, it's 90 out of 104. I think there is... There are a few moments where you do kind of have to have seen Journey's End, if not just because these are the Cult of Skaro, the same Daleks from that story, but there are a few references to Rose, and especially because that's the last time we saw the Daleks, and that trauma is clearly still fresh in Ten's mind.
Yep.
It's one of the many great lines of this episode. They survive. They always survive while I lose everything. It's such a pure distillation of the Dr. Dalek relationship.
Yeah, for sure.
And you could definitely watch Daleks in Manhattan before you watch Evolution of the Daleks.
Oh, no question. Those 14 people who said no are insane. With timescales out of the way, I just want to jump in right now and explain one of the main things that I really, really appreciate about this story, at least parts of this story, and the parts I remember the most, and that is they really make a sincere and earnest attempt to make the Daleks scary.
Yeah.
Like, especially in part one, there's a few shots of, like, the shadows of the Dalek Ice Stalk coming down the corridor, the way they're lit, the way they're shot, like, when the Doctor's hiding with Tallulah and the Dalek glides past, the music is, like, threatening and the lights are great. And also that one shot when Martha's talking to the Dalek and it's a really close-up shot of the Dalek Ice Stalk.
Yeah, the rapid close-up, I assume that's what you're referring to. It is interesting. I think the direction and the editing is, I guess, surprisingly experimental. And as you say, it's all sort of... geared towards making the Daleks really seem menacing. But I would even say that menacing quality goes into a lot of the writing because the ruthlessness is really on display and demonstrating that the Daleks, just because of, I don't know, how they're created and even the, I don't know, Dalek culture, I guess, they can't, even the Cult of Skaro, they just can't think outside that horrible, nasty, bigoted little box, the bigoted little shell they're shoved in, so to speak. And it becomes really disturbing. And, you know, there are particular moments where that becomes clear, particularly with, I don't know which Dalek it was, but one of the Daleks when they're flying in the air and they're confronted by Solomon. Like, there's a tragedy there because you know what's going to happen, right? Yeah. Like, if you've watched this show, you know how that interaction's going to end. But it still has that sort of potent sense of tragedy, even if it's based in, you know, a bit of dramatic irony. But the fact that that scene exists at all, I think, emphasizes that, I guess, kind of existential horror, really, that the Daleks present in this story and in other stories.
Yes, that whole, no reasoning and no, there's no
emotion.
No, yeah, no, and no getting through that thick skull, so to speak, as well.
Yeah.
But I think that scene is also worth highlighting just because of Dalek sex, like, gasp of horror when Solomon is killed. And that moment is really shocking.
Yeah.
It's like the first time we've ever, ever seen a Dalek express any kind of remorse, even a little bit.
Yeah.
Which is like, it's just a great, like, really, like, quick way of showing, oh, hang on a minute, what's happening to Dalek Sec? And there's, like, a few different conversations, and this is, like, the meat of the episode. It's the whole, like, it's the evolution of the Daleks, like, literally. There's one conversation in the first episode when Dalek Sec is, like, explaining to his cronies why they've got to do this and they're still on the fence. And in that moment, Dalek Sec is still coming from an authoritarian perspective, right?
Mm.
But then as he experiences more human things, it shifts. And we see that when he has that conversation with the doctor in the genetics lab. And we see him, like, without question and without hesitation, reject Davros's philosophy.
Mm.
And like the speed at which he does it after the doctor mentions him, it catches me off guard kind of every time. Like, is there's again, like, there's no hesitation whatsoever. He just immediately goes, he was wrong to think that. And the doctor's like, sorry, he was what?
Yeah.
That stuff to me is like really, really, really interesting. And as far as I'm aware, it's the only time a Dalek has ever had this philosophy. I mean, we'll get to Rusty, a good Dalek with the 12th Doctor era a bit later on, but the less said about Into the Dalek, the better. And that's the stuff that really I remember the most from this story. It's because, as I've said time and time again, and I mentioned it with Gridlock as well, it's pointless to bring back a recurring villain if you're not going to do something new with them. And this is a really earnest attempt to do something new with them. And
yeah,
that's just something I really, really appreciate here.
Same.
Whether or not it 100% sticks the landing, we'll get to. But those conversations and those scenes and those moments are fantastic.
Yeah, the fact that they're attempting these themes at all, and the fact that they're working out as well as they do, there's something very compelling about it. And again, I think it sort of goes back to what I said earlier. The second episode is a lot more compelling for me than the first, even if it's because we're seeing the fruition of all of those things.
One thing that I will say is that the final experiment and the nature and shape, I guess, of the human Daleks, it's not that impressive in my eyes. Because, like, what we're presented with in the episode, like, we're told that they've got Dalek DNA in them, and there's, like, a bit of Time Lord somehow, and blah, blah, blah. But, yeah, like, what we end up getting are essentially drones. Like, they're pretty close to just being Cybermen. It's, like, humans that have been turned, and they've got no emotion. But, like, we don't really see any Dalek. Like, even though there isn't that, even though there's a little bit of Time Lord in there, like, all I'm seeing is a brainwashed human army with Dalek guns. And when I'm promised human Dalek hybrids with Dalek sex DNA as a template, what we do get is kind of disappointing.
Yeah.
Doesn't that prove that they were wrong all along?
I mean, it could, if that was, like, ever the point of the ending, and not just, oh, it's a good thing that Doctor latched himself onto the mast of the Empire State Building to throw a bit of Time Lord in the mix. If it was a case of the Daleks have been wrong all along, that's not really what is presented to us.
Hmm.
It reminded me of, I'm going to bring up One Piece if no one minds, but there's an arc where there's one of the biggest giants that ever existed, and this mad scientist has its quartz, and so it steals the soul of Luffy and puts it into this thing, and it's like, finally, I have the ultimate warrior, and then the giant, all he wants to do is eat.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'd certainly believe that. That's interesting.
But yeah, like, that's, like, if we're talking about the thematic nature of the story not quite landing, like, that's an element of it. I don't think it completely ruins it entirely, because I do think that the focus, for the most part, is on the cult of Skaro.
Hmm. Well, here's another... This is just a bit of an idea. So it's established that Diagoras himself, his nature is obviously very sort of motivated by greed and ambition. Indeed, that's why the Daleks see him, you know, fit for this experiment.
Mm, yeah.
Would it not have been more, cohesive, I guess, to highlight those darker elements in Diagoras' nature, like him individually, and how easily, you know, how susceptible he personally would be to, you know, the Daleks' horrible ideology, and maybe highlight a conflict there? I get that would overcomplicate the story a little bit, and we obviously want to get to, Dalek sex overcoming of, all that evil. But I wonder, would that not have been more interesting? And you also, in doing that, could mix the themes together, because obviously, you know, Diagoras, his ambition and greed is very, I think certainly rooted in capitalist horror. I know, like, seeing that and, I don't know, comparing it or merging it, I suppose, with the bigotry of the Daleks. I'm not sure, maybe that would work that way. I'm reminded of a YouTube essayist who I'm fairly fond of called Dan Pilskin. It's a channel called Innuendo Studios, and in one video he talks about fascism, and there's a bit where he, I think, basically says that capitalism and fascism seem to have certain links. And he basically says, you know, whether you want to interpret that as capitalism being very susceptible to fascist ideologies, or capitalism just being fascism light, that's, you know, up to you to decide. But that sort of stuff makes me think, maybe there is a connection you could make here between Diagoras's, you know, horrible capitalist beliefs and the Daleks' horrible beliefs, and they don't really merge them together. Does that make sense?
I think so, yeah. I mean, it's like, I think it is similar to the Davros audio drama that we reviewed a while back. Like,
yeah, but that I think does it slightly better. Granted,
oh, no, it absolutely does it better, but like, yeah, it's a little similar.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. I just think maybe there was a better way to sort of meld it all together. That being said, what we get here is still very ambitious and really compelling, it must be said.
Yeah, sorry, I just went on a bit of a tangent because I was curious about something. It was the Fifth Doctor Dalek story. Remind me of the name again? They all just sort of blend together.
Resurrection.
Resurrection, yes. You've mentioned that episode has one of the highest kill counts of any Doctor Who story. In this story, there's like there's established to be like 1,000 or more human Daleks, and they all get genocided at the end. So I was trying to figure out the numbers on that one and try and work out if that changes things. I think we don't see that many die on screen, but they obviously all die. I couldn't find that answer, but what I did find was a website, and this was released before the 13th Doctor, and it tots up every single Doctor's confirmed kill count. Is a little interesting to see. It's counted deaths that they're complicit in as like half counts.
Yeah, yeah.
And Daleks are also included in this kill tally, so it's not just humans. Do you want to have a guess at who the Doctor with the highest confirmed kill count is?
I can imagine it.
Baker.
I mean, a grim part of me that kind of hopes that's true. I will mention, just as a small correction, the YouTuber I just mentioned, his name is... Sorry, excuse me, let me check this. Ian Danskin. Nearly got it right. Anyway, so yeah, I'm going to go Colin Baker on this one.
Also of the War Doctor, I don't know if we're going to count that.
The War Doctor isn't listed here because we don't find out how many lives he took in the Time War.
Actually, no, is it David Tennant?
It's not. So, here we go. Colin Baker doesn't crack the top 5.
Wow.
Oh.
He got accused of genocide in Trial of a Time Lord. That's
he did, yeah. So the Doctor with the third highest kill count is the first Doctor. And that's largely because of, in the Daleks' master plan, he destroys an army of like 5,000 Daleks.
I'd believe that, actually.
The Doctor with the second highest kill count is the 11th Doctor.
Ooh. Interesting.
This is due to three reasons. He has the credit for the death of all the silence on Earth when he rises up humanity and convinces them to kill them all when they see him. Also, in Nightmare in Silver, there are 3 million Daleks that are destroyed by the end of that story. And Time of the Doctor, he's there for 900 years, and there are heaps of deaths that happen in the Siege of Trenzalore across the 900 years, so that's part of the reason his kill count is so ramped up.
Yeah, but I believe that.
He doesn't even come close to the confirmed kill count of the 7th Doctor.
Oh, of course.
Yes.
Because, yes.
All because, in Remembrance of the Daleks, he destroys Skaro, and in the novelization, there's more than a billion Daleks there.
Yep. That sounds about right.
So
I was writing for like a planet death thing.
I mean, it's sort of that. It is sort of a planet death thing. It's the death of Skaro.
Yeah.
Which does handily bring us back to Daleks in Manhattan, because Skaro is mentioned in this story. And at first glance, it's a bit of a plot hole. Because if Skaro is destroyed in Remembrance, Dalek, I think, Thay mentions it was destroyed in the Time War. So at first glance, you think, hang on a minute, something's not right there. But then you remember it's a Time War. And a huge point of the Time War is that both the Daleks and the Time Lords kept traveling into the past, rewriting history, changing time, changing the future. So it's very, very feasible, and in fact implied in this story, that part of what the Daleks did in the Time War is resurrect Skaro to help bolster their numbers against the Time Lords. It's a bit of world-building you have to put some thought into, but, I mean, it makes sense and is kind of cool.
Yeah, I think, given that that does seem like a bit of a plot hole, it certainly doesn't ruin it. I just had a weird thought. Maybe there's an implication that when the Doctor destroyed Skaro, maybe that's when the Time War started. I mean, God, that'd be interesting. Anyway,
I mean, the amount of times we could point to a moment from Classic Who and say, maybe this is what kickstarted the Time War. I'm sure there
are. Yeah, I mean,
this is the moment Walter White became Heisenberg.
See, oh no, genuinely, Hadley, you joke, but as we'll, I think, see when we look at Battlefield, and as we've discussed on this podcast, there was a concerted effort during the last couple of Sylvester McCoy's years to make the Doctor a very chilling, manipulative, and almost Machiavellian figure. So that's interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly where in canon in the show that moment began, but that's certainly a pretty valid interpretation.
And that was one of my issues with Remembrance as well, and it was that the Doctor was way more of a schemer than a responder. Like, how in most, like, because I don't think you definitely haven't seen it, Hadley, but for context, basically the Doctor has sorted out the entire conflict by like episode 2 or 3, and then watches all of the building blocks click together. There's this thing that the Daleks are after, and a lot of the episode is trying to protect, stop them from doing so. At the end of episode 4, they do get it, but it turns out the Doctor reprogrammed it to be a nuclear bomb that destroys Skaro. Yeah. And it happened off-screen way earlier in the piece.
Mm-hmm. And, thematically, as Cuff pointed out, that is a little disturbing. It's sort of saved a bit by that last line of the Doctor, where he's like, you know, time will tell, it always does, as to whether it was a good decision or not. But anyway, point is, yes, the 7th Doctor becomes a bit more Machiavellian, I suppose, at that point. Anyway, getting back to
this, high kill counts are from Daleks as well. So it's like, you know, murder's bad.
And, like, that is kind of like, I mean, I think the majority of those deaths, I mean, almost certainly the majority of those deaths are monsters and creatures and aliens. I don't think there are many. I'll have to really comb through that website and see if there are any odd deaths that are attributed to the Doctor in any way.
Yeah.
Martha. Let's talk about Martha now.
Sure.
I don't know how strong a Martha episode this is. She doesn't have a lot to do despite the episode's length.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think when it hits the last half of episode two, the episode decides to give her things to do. Like, she figures out, like, she's helping people in Hooverville. She figures out the Daleks' plan to some extent. She weaponizes lightning against the pig slaves. And it's nice that after doing so, the episode chooses to give Martha a moment of, they used to be human and I killed them. It's a really nice character moment for her.
Yeah, for sure. And by the way, so this is a slight digression, we can talk about it more later. The way that the, you know, pig slaves are depicted in the narrative, I find it to be a lot more, you know, ethically good than the way the Ood were portrayed in the Impossible Planet and the Satan Pit, for example.
Yes, absolutely, correct.
That was quite refreshing.
And look, there's still a season before Doctor Who gets to walk back its mistreatment of the Ood and, like, fix that issue. But you're right.
Is it a house elf situation?
Basically, in Impossible Planet, they're introduced as a slave race, but it's framed like, oh no, they want to, and if you don't give them orders, they just sort of wither away, and that's as uncritically as the episode looks at it. And because the huge bulk of the Ood's purpose in that episode is to be possessed by the Beast. But then in Series 4, we learn, no, that's just a narrative that the Ood Company wants you to think. As it turns out, they are being subjugated, and it is truly terrible behavior. Let's fix that now.
Yeah.
But yeah, the pig slaves here, definitely better than Ood in that story.
Yeah.
Sure. But yeah, Martha, I think a huge bulk of the story in terms of what she does, it's like sort of following behind the Doctor as he does a lot of stuff. And she does have a moment where she is captured by the pig slaves, which I do need to mention, because once again, people are going to say, oh, but you're pointing out when Rose gets captured, but not when Martha does. No, I'll point it out here. I pointed it out with Gridlock, and that one I defended it because she actually did stuff. Here she gets captured and then does, like, nothing. Like, she asks questions about to the Daleks when prompted by the Doctor, but her being getting captured doesn't serve that much of a narrative purpose. Like, we see all of the Daleks' behavior while she is captured from two perspectives, from Martha's and the Doctor's watching on. And those scenes with her and the Daleks are good. Like, she stands up to them and she does defend the people. So it's nice character stuff for her. But in terms of actual stuff she does in the narrative, not an awful lot. Which
that's a fair point.
Yeah, and like, again, it is a bit of a shame because I do sort of have the same opinion about quite a few of the side characters in the story.
Yeah,
Frank doesn't do an awful lot. Solomon. He has a lot of fun character stuff, and he's a good character, but even in part one, he doesn't have an awful lot to do. Tallulah's
main job... I have some fun stuff to say about Solomon, but maybe we'll save it for later.
We'll save Solomon for later. Tallulah has her own character arc, but in terms of her active involvement in the narrative, it's not terribly much as well. Which is a shame. It's a bit weird, because there is a big supporting cast, and, like, on their own, they're interesting characters, and they're well defined and they're well introduced. But I'm not sure how well implemented they are.
Yeah, well, I think maybe that
Garfield gets nothing to do.
Does he?
Well, sorry, did you say nothing or something to do, Hadley?
Nothing.
Yeah.
Well, yes, that's true.
Yeah.
Well, his only role is at the end to welcome Laszlo into Hooverville, and it's a nice moment, that one. But otherwise, he's mainly there as the, he is the surrogate person from this time period who's going to follow the Doctor around character.
Would you say that he's a bit of comic relief, or would you not go quite that far?
I mean, not terribly. Like, he's got a few moments at the beginning, like, when he scoffs at Mr. Diagoras. Mm-hmm. But, like, I don't even know if he's, like, I don't know. I don't remember anything he said that was, like, terribly funny, at least.
Well, here's the thing, right, in terms of, you know, the lack of presence he has in the narrative, When I watched this story, you know, the second time this week, I actually thought that when he gets sort of dragged down with the, you know, the pig slave horde under the manhole thing, I actually thought he died at that point. I'd forgotten that he was in the rest of the narrative, so maybe that does speak to the fact that he doesn't have that much of an impact. Like, he's got that bit of, at the end where, again, he welcomes Laszlo to Hooverville, but you wondered, could that not have been done by another character, or... Anyway, the point is, yeah, he doesn't have a massive impact. Same with Tallulah, I guess. Like, it's more of how the narrative is impacting her, and that's fine. It's a nice characterization, but is it all sort of, you know, fitting together terribly well? That doesn't bother me personally, but
no,
it's still a criticism to bring up.
Well, for me, it's like a lot of their good moments are more character-driven, right? Like, Tallulah has a lot of fun and just good conversations with Martha regarding her series arc. Frank's reaction to Solomon's death is genuinely heart-wrenching.
Yeah.
And when he is discovered to be alive, it is like a moment of relief because the episode does a lot to make him likable in the first few minutes he's on screen. But I do think it is strange that, like, maybe it's because a big focus is on the Daleks and their what they're doing and what their involvement is and how they change. And that's a little different from a story like, say, let's bring it back to the Impossible Planet, right? Every crew member in that story has something to do, and they've got a role to play.
Yeah. Well, Sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
Well, in that story, you don't have, like the Ood have their role, but they don't have, there's no, like, Ood in fighting, and there's no, like, let's have these Ood chat to each other about what's going on, and that takes away from the side characters.
Yeah, like, well, I think that that's kind of the issue. Like, the cast is so big in this story, it's focusing on so many of these characters, it almost kind of buckles under the weight of a lot of its ambitions, because they've got the heavy thematic stuff they've got to focus on, they've got all these different characters with their own character arcs, and they have to make them, you know, at least slightly compelling. So it doesn't all fit together, and it also explains why Martha gets sort of, I don't know if I'd say like a backseat, but she doesn't have a massively prominent role in the narrative, just because she has to make room for all of these different characters, and
like, this is Martha's, what, fourth, I think, story? She's so far been, her average has been generally good. Like, for her first and third stories, she's had really good stuff to do. Her second and fourth, not an awful lot. But it's still a better average than Rose at this point. And that's all I'll say on the matter. Do you want to talk about Solomon now?
I wanted to mention one thing about Martha.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
So there was a funny scene with Martha. I don't know what it was. It was like this little green glowing egg thing. I don't know if it got a payoff or I was just not paying attention. But she's like, is it radioactive or something? And then she gets right up into it.
She does. I mean, I think she does that after the Doctor does. And I think she's taking cues from him in that moment where it's like, oh, he's not worried about it. I guess I don't have to be either. You're right about that green brain not having a huge, like, it's set up as, it is mentioned in part two, and like that is, it's said that that was the Daleks' first plan to create new Daleks before they ended up switching to their make humans Daleks plan. It just didn't work out. They didn't have like the proper technology here, and it's also used to clue the Doctor in that
the Daleks are involved.
But I've seen other people highlight that as like an issue as well, where it's like it's set up as a big thing and it doesn't pay off. I don't think it is intended to be set up as this massive mystery. Like,
yeah, I don't think so either.
Pretty quickly, and it does it get explained.
Yeah. It does its job.
It does its job, but I do think there is, like, because it's like the first thing in the episode that doesn't get an immediate explanation, right? Because a lot of the stuff is explained to the audience when Daleks appear and start talking to Mr. Daggerus and all that stuff. And this is one of the first things that is a question mark, so maybe that's why by the end people are like, oh, it didn't have as much of an impact as I was expecting. I guess that's a knock against the episode. And it might be, but again, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's pretty fair criticisms.
Anything else about Martha before we move on to Solomon?
I'm good. It's Solomon time, baby.
Cool. You can kick this off, Hadley.
Yeah.
I thought Solomon was a bit of a magical black man trope. If you're unfamiliar with the trope, it's basically like they don't need to have magic powers, but you'll see it a lot in Stephen King stories. There's this black man who's like the epitome of morality. He's like a beacon of inspiration to everyone, and he tragically dies. So then the white people have to take after him.
Yeah. I mean, there are like, that is quite a bit of what Solomon is. And if you don't know the trope, he is still like a strong character.
But in context.
In context, yeah. I think the moment, for me, the moment that saves it somewhat is when he admits to the doctor that he sacrificed Frank because he was scared himself. Like, that is one of the few moments that shows like a character flaw.
Yeah.
And it humanizes him beyond being a walking trope that I think is needed.
Yeah.
But it is a very, very small moment and doesn't really get brought up again. I guess he does overcome his fear when he addresses the Daleks at the end. So maybe that was the intention.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, and I noted this after when I was watching it the second time. His name's Solomon, and then there's that bit at the beginning where he takes the loaf of bread and breaks it in half, and I just thought, I mean, that could have been more subtle, I guess, so.
I mean, Tallulah has her name because she's directly named after a character from Bugsy Malone.
Yeah, I guess so.
There are a few references and nods here.
There was some other biblical reference near the end that I can't remember.
The doctor says you should baptize the new Dalek humans by having them
kill baptize them. Yeah, that's it.
Which is such a powerful line. It's just like, baptize these Daleks just as a way of goading them is really great.
Baptized in blood, I suppose. Yeah. Oh, no, that's the other thing I just remembered. It's when Dalek Sek says, if you choose death and destruction will choose you, which in my opinion is basically a spin on, you know, live by the sword, die by the sword. So, anyway, going back to Solomon, I do see what you mean, Hadley. It's, again, I didn't think about it that much, but now that that's been pointed out to me in context of that trope, yeah, that's a bit of a, it's a bit unfortunate.
He's also the only, like, Dalek set, the final skirmish between the Daleks aside, he's the only character that gets exterminated in the entire story.
Yeah. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that.
Neither did I until I saw it happen and went, oh yeah, it's the first one. And it does, I think, I understand the intention, where it's like, this is the first time that Martha, Frank, the Whovervillians, any one of them have actually seen what the Daleks are capable of. Because before that point, they're just firing warning shots to try and get them all in the one area, to try and cut them off to become part of the final experiment. But then they actually exterminate, and it's like, the moment is intended to be like this, oh no, they're not fucking around. Like, they're deadly serious. But in context of the trope,
You start to really wonder, you know, what was going on there.
Yeah, not quite great. I'm not sure. I would be very it's something I can very easily discover right now. When you're listening to this, the BBC recently put out a whole bunch of scripts from Doctor Who online, so I can go into the script library now and see if, like, Solomon's race is ever mentioned in the script as a casting thing. So yes, it is directly referenced in the script that he's black.
Right.
Doctor Who writers, you are screwed.
I'm sure they had good intentions, but like,
that is often the case with this trope, where it's like, yeah, I'm making the black man the good guy. Look at me, I'm not racist.
But it's also it's like an element of what I'm going to call the Captain Marvel problem, where it's like, you give your female protagonist so much strength that there is no weakness, and everyone just goes, this isn't better, this is not a character.
happen because, like, Solomon isn't the main character. And yeah. It's not like Captain Marvel is a martyr for inspiration to everyone else.
Yeah, I mean, they're different things. But, yeah, I get what you mean. I really enjoy the ending of this story for a few different reasons. The standoff between the Doctor and Dalek Khan in the lab is really great, and just the way it's edited, and it's like it really gives it the seriousness it deserves, where it's like this is truly the last Dalek facing off against the last Time Lord. And a lot of the Doctor's language is really great, where he offers Dalek Khan an out by saying, "I've seen one genocide, I won't cause another."
Yeah, that was,
which is just so classically in character.
Yep. And yet, in a way, there's a bit of subversion there, because you know that the Doctor really hates the Daleks for understandable reasons. So I think in those moments, maybe there is always a tension where you wonder, oh, have the Daleks pushed the Doctor too far this time? You know, what's he going to do? But here, you know, as in days past, the Doctor chooses the path of peace, and there's something really resonant about that. And it becomes even more, I guess, powerful when we see the consequences of this in Journey's End when Dalek Khan comes back. So, yeah,
we're gonna have this final episode of the Dalek Cult of Skaro trilogy in a while. But then Laszlo comes in and he's dying, and the Doctor resolves to save him, or at least stabilize him. And he's giving this big speech about no more death, and the music is swelling. Murray Gold's score, excellent throughout the entire story, by the way.
Yeah, I love the score in this story, more so than in compared to most of Murray Gold's scores, actually.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of instances of the choir coming in to accompany the Daleks. I think the track is literally called Evolution of the Daleks. Mm. But another musical moment I noticed this time around is when the Daleks are carting out Dalek Sek in chains, and he's crawling like a dog onto the stage. Mm. The music that they use in that scene is taken directly from their first appearance at the end of Army of Ghosts. It's the exact same music track. So it's basically like the return, like emergence of the Cult of Skaro Part 2. And just tying it all together, being like the first time we saw them and the last time we're going to see them.
It's really,
really, really great. I really love it so much. Yeah. And that's essentially how the episode ends. Like it's like the last 20 minutes are generally pretty bleak and full of death. But then like we do get that happy ending with Laszlo and Tallulah, which I think is really, really well earned.
Yeah. Well,
one of the things though is like Laszlo grows on you. Like he's the character who's had like this really horrible thing happen to him, but he's still trying to help, and he's still pushing through, and he's trying to hide how exhausted he is because there's work to be done.
Yeah.
And it's really easy to him, and you really feel like it gets like, yes, go for it, when the Doctor's like, oh, I'm saving you.
Yeah. There's the ending, it's doing a lot, and it's obviously compelling, but also very admirable, just, you know, how many elements are sort of coming together. You could argue that maybe there are some weaker parts in the narrative overall with the story, but I can't think of really any narrative beats in that last 20 minutes that don't hit home. I think it's very powerful, and as you say, Cuff, all of the sort of dramatic beats, they feel very well earned, and there's just something kind of great about that. So,
One last thing I want to mention, and we've got other stuff we can talk about, but one more thing I want to tack on is I mentioned I love how scary the Daleks are, but they haven't lost the sass from Journey's End.
Oh, yeah.
That one moment where, I don't know which Dalek, but they say, you told us to imagine and we imagined your
irrelevance. Yeah,
great.
I did imagine, you know, the air horns going off in my head when I when I heard that line.
It takes you right back to, this is not war, this is pest control.
Yeah.
And it just shows, like, no, these are still the Cult of Skaro. They're still going to sling insults and barbs and sass. It's really great.
Yeah. And
I love when one of them's like, do you have doubts about Dalek Sek? And the other one just like spins its little vision thing around and then spins it back around to make sure no one's listening. Affirmative.
That's really funny when you see it happen. But again, that is like a really just interesting scene in general, because it's like, again, like the shades of the Dalek infighting, but also just like Daleks gossiping, essentially.
Yeah, which is, and that feels uncommon, because there is, as we've said, in Doctor Who's history, there are, you know, Dalek faction wars that crop up, but there's not really any scenes like that.
No.
The Daleks, even when they're conversing, even if that, you know, like you see them conversing, like the ones in one faction will converse with each other and the ones in the other faction will converse with each other, but they're very single-minded. There's not really a lot of deliberation. It's just we're the true Daleks, they're the bad ones, you know, destroy. So I don't know whether that would necessarily have to be unique to the Cult of Skaro, or whether that's just something new we can explore, you know, in this series. But it's quite compelling nonetheless. And I must say, what's the name of the writer again?
Ellen Rayner.
Yeah. Is this her first script in Doctor Who?
She goes on to write the Sontaran two-parter next season.
Nice. That's great. But it's really impressive that, you know, for a first-time writer, that she understands these characters that well. And that, again, all of these themes are sort of fitting together as cohesively as they are. It's really, really cool.
Yeah. Just to tie back in a conversation we had earlier on, I've looked up the magical the trope that you mentioned, Hadley. Interestingly, this episode isn't listed on TV Tropes. This episode isn't listed as an example of that trope. What is, though, is Remembrance of the Daleks. That old Dalek story we keep coming back to.
Yeah.
This
episode,
give me the context for that.
What this episode says, I don't remember much of it, but it's like the Doctor is helped out by a black man who serves tea in a cafe while inexplicably offering philosophical insights based on the enslavement of his ancestors.
Yep. And he's played, I'm pretty sure I saw somewhere that he's played by the guy who plays, I'm forgetting his name, but the butler in Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. But yes, he gives a discussion, like some insight when he's discussing with the Doctor the nature of the passing of time, I guess, and the impacts that people's choices make. That does make sense.
I think to end this conversation, Hadley, you mentioned early on that you found a couple of the Doctor's moments to be, I think, out of character or something like that. Do you want to detail those now?
Hmm.
Yeah, I was about to bring that up. It's mainly the one thing. I just thought it was strange how on board he was with, like, the human Dalek race that was, like, sex idea.
Oh, as in, like, how eager he is to assist.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe. I think the thought process there is, like, Dalek was pretty clear in saying there's no way to get them back to who they were.
Yeah. So any semblance.
Like, he's not skeptical that Dalek is, like, putting on an act, that he's just, like, creating more Daleks through human shells.
I mean, I think it comes back to the fact that he was so quick to be like, no, Davros was wrong. And the mind is like, that is such an extreme thing for a Dalek to say. And to risk saying it with other Daleks in the room, he must be serious.
It's the sincerity. His sincerity comes across quite quickly and very potently. So it does make sense that the Doctor would want to collaborate. I think it maybe just goes back to, you know, the Doctor doesn't want to lose anybody else. And if there's a chance to bring these humans back, I guess.
And also, he has a lot of questions. He has a lot of questions before he does it as well. You know, he drops the whole, are these guys going to help? And he also says this world isn't big enough for two species. So he drops that as well. Like, he puts up a bit of resistance, but then as soon as all those questions are answered, he goes, oh, this is actually a chance to change the trajectory of the Daleks and not make them so bloodthirsty and warmongering, which has been a pain in my ass for the last 900 years.
Yeah.
But I brought that quote up because when I heard David Tennant say, I was like, what about the Silurians, guys?
Sorry, when was that? I don't know why I'm forgetting.
So
that.
when it's right at the end of that big conversation that Dalek Sek and the Doctor have, and it's like basically the last bit of resistance the Doctor puts up, where he says this planet, this city, and this planet are full already, and the Dalek Seekers says, you have your TARDIS, we can take you, you can take us to a different planet so we can start over, or something to that effect. And you, I guess you're right, the Silurians technically still exist in this world.
Yeah, I mean...
Revival Who hadn't brought them up yet, and also, you know, there's no... I don't think there was much risk of any colonies emerging in 1930 New York, so it's better to keep them out of it, because it just makes things a bit too confused, people who don't know them, but that is a good point.
Yeah, I mean... So is it the Doctor who says that this world is not quite big enough for...
Yes.
Okay, yeah, no, that is a little odd, because the Doctor... Hang on.
Let me find the actual full quote, because...
Sure.
Like, he says something akin to that, and then that's when Dalek Sek counters with, okay, take us somewhere else in your TARDIS. Let me see. Yeah, so the full quote, there's no room on Earth for another race of people. That's what the Doctor says. And then Sek says, you have your TARDIS, take us across the stars, find us a new home, and allow the new Daleks to start again. And that's what ultimately convinces the Doctor to get to work.
Well, I guess that's character progression, but it is a bit odd that was his first reaction, especially given brokering...
That's not his first reaction. Like, there's still a lot that the conversation has, but like that is what his that is like the final thing that he says, and I think he's only really saying that because, again, they are Daleks.
Yeah,
and
maybe
what he's trying to do there is try and do the whole, this isn't a thing where I'm gonna help you out and then you're gonna go, thank you, Doctor, unfortunately, based on resources, we now have to kill more humans so we have room to live here.
Yeah.
Like, just, he's just trying to tick off all the last boxes until he says, okay.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. Because, like, especially with the Silurians and the Sea Devils, like, in those stories, he definitely tries to be, you know, to get in the role of peacemaker and tries to, I don't know, bridge the divide, I suppose. So maybe it is a bit odd that he said that, but in context, it relatively makes sense. Yeah.
Was there anything else, Hadley?
On my last note, Dalek's deck kind of sounds like Werner Herzog.
Who does?
Dalek's the human Dalek.
Yeah. I guess so. Yeah, I can kind of see that.
But yeah, if that's all we have to say, I think we've pretty much thoroughly dissected this one at this point.
Something else I was gonna bring up.
Yeah.
Can't for the life of me remember what it was.
Oh yeah, I just had a fun note, and that was like, haha, Andrew Garfield's in New York. But that was it. Like, and it's not really worth commenting on.
This is a small thing, but the fact that the Doctor is able to make you know, that device that reads the Dalek experiment genetic code thing, whatever it is. Like, I can just believe it, but I would want it... I'm not sure if he'd be able to do that just with his sonic screwdriver and a piece of tech from the 1930s. Like, if he brought something from the TARDIS, if he had some piece of alien tech, I guess, that might make a bit more sense, but
I was wondering if you were going to bring this up or not, and to that I would kind of look at what the Daleks were able to do with 1930s technology.
I assumed it was because, I mean, granted, I'm making, some assumptions here, but I assumed it's because they integrated their own technology into, you know, with the 1930s Earth technology.
But even still, I mean, like, my main sticking point, because, like, a lot of it is largely, like, we see that they've taken their own Dalekanium panels. They haven't just found Dalekanium here.
Yeah, yeah.
But then they were also able to manufacture 1,000 Dalek weapons. And because they emergency temporal shifted here, it's not like they've got a spaceship.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, unless did they still have that, you know, TARDIS thingy from
the Genesis Arc went into the void.
Maybe all the tech was in there. Maybe they just had an excess of Dalek guns.
It went into the void, ship. Though.
Sorry,
went into the void. It's not it's not accessible to them.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. I think
like the Doctor, like, MacGyvering random shit out of the technology of the time is nothing new either.
Oh yeah, no, that's definitely true. I think I want to say there are other examples that do it better, and even if they don't, that's not like an excuse, but it certainly doesn't ruin the story for me. It's just something that stuck out to me when I was watching it. I think I had similar problems with when the Doctor, the 13th Doctor, created a new sonic screwdriver, and anyway, that's a whole other thing. But
yeah, one last thing I'll say on this is, like, even in this example, it's not like he's like, it's not like he's got all this stuff cobbled together and then he's able to like really accurately scan the thing. Like, he still has to put a lot of thought in. Like, and we see him, like, he gets the data, and I assume he's working this out based on like resonation and like, you know, interaction with light and the sound frequency and all that stuff.
Electrical signals, maybe.
Yeah, and then he still has to like piece together in his head which planet it is.
It's yeah,
like
which
just
is
comes up with a massive readout on planet of origin, Skaro. This is a artificial Dalek embryo designed to blah blah blah. Like, he still has to like,
yeah, yeah.
He's reading what he can from what he's got, and then piecing the rest together in his head, which I think is a bit different.
I guess so, and because he's not really reading anything from a screen. He's just kind of listening to it, I suppose. And he's obviously using his extensive Time Lord knowledge of genetics and the genetic history of different planets. In a way, you wonder, you know, should it have taken him that long to figure out it was Skaro, given, you know, how much the Daleks have impacted his life? But either way, it, as you say, it works fine enough. Yeah, sure. I guess it's really not that much of a problem.
Yeah, I think that brings us to the end of our discussion handily here.
Yeah, I think
here.
So too.
A lot to think about with this one. I think it, in general, it's got some pretty high highs and some mid-mids. I don't think anything about this episode is like outright bad, depending on your interpretation of some of the tropes that this episode has in it. I'm still going to give this episode an 8, though.
Same.
Hadley?
Hey, so Dalek in Manhattan will get a 6, and Evolution will get a 7.
Cool.
Sure.
Okay, Hadley, you'll be in the next episode on that podcast as well, but just in case people don't listen to that one, is there anything here you'd like to plug?
You Will Beware is back. We filmed Sunday, and
hell
I'm hoping it will come out tomorrow. We are reviewing Beast from the East and Say Cheese and Die Again. I forgot that one for very good reasons. It will be long out by the time that this goes out, but yeah, definitely check it out. We won't have another one out by that time, I don't imagine. So maybe we'll do Oscar's movie down at Stalebred.
Yes, that will absolutely be out by the time this episode releases. Go watch that.
I
believe at this point all three of us should be involved in that one.
Yes.
Exciting times.
Yeah.
But next week we're going to be discussing one of the last episodes of the classic series, Battlefield.
Yeah.
Until then, I'm Alex.
I'm Fitz.
I'm Hadley.
And, hey, I'm walking here. Thanks for listening. If you want to get in touch with us, we have our own email account, twowhosreview@gmail.com. You can ask us some questions about our show, or even if you disagree with something and you want to get it off your chest. Again, be civil, but definitely get in touch and let us know. We might read out your emails on a future episode of the podcast and put you on blast, or put ourselves on blast if we agree with you way too much. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week for more. Goodbye.